All right. Cool. So the beginning of the source sheet here kind of, it's not a continuation of last week per se, but it connects, certainly. Last week, just really briefly, kind of presented Ralph Korman's approach to the sale of the Bechorah. Not last week. Last time we had Shir, which was Parshas Toldos, the week before last. And how he thinks the sale of the Bechorah wasn't the sale of the birthright per se, but the rights to marry Leah, which is certainly a unique approach. And when we spoke about it, it didn't really present whether or not, you know, that holds up in terms of all the psukim across this whole story or not. I think we'll touch on that a little bit now, because he also has a very interesting approach to the story of Yaakov wrestling the quote-unquote Ish, where he says, yes, Judaism does accept the idea of a malach, of angels, but I don't think that's what's happening in this story. He thinks it's an actual person, because according to him, there's no hint whatsoever in the psukim that this should be a malach. It says Ish, and there's no other hint to send me in any other direction. So, as a result, he takes that as his base assumption that it's an actual person and latches on to the Midrash in Source 1, which is, he quotes from Torah Shlema of Rav Kasher, from Midrash Agada, where it says, Hatzlini na miyad achi, save me now, where this is Yaakov praying to Hashem. Achi, Shabbat elai mekochel shal Esav. Achi doesn't mean Esav, it means the man named Achi, who came, he's coming under the authority of Esav. He was sent by Esav. As it were, the way Rav Korman presents it, he was kind of a spy who was shadowing Yaakov. He doesn't really say for how long, but there's a gap between Parshas Toldos and now of something like 34 years, I think. So was he shadowing him for 34 years? It's a little... that's one weakness of Rav Korman's approach, I think. But so Shibasha Shishalach... Yitzchak is Yaakov leparan Aram. Shigar Esav ish achrav sheshmo Achi. And then that's how, in turn, that Esav knows that Yaakov is trying to meet him, is coming to meet him. Because when at the beginning of the Parsha in Vayishlach, when Yaakov sends the Malachim to Esav, they reach Esav and they see that he's prepared to come meet Yaakov. So how did Esav know? Because Achi told him. And then with the wrestling match, when he can't beat Yaakov, when Achi can't beat Yaakov, he apparently has Esav's permission to give him a bracha, which means that he's saying, yeah, we agree that you have the rights to Birchas Avraham, you have the rights to the lineage, and Esav is now kind of foregoing the right to that. That I also thought was very interesting. I don't know that, would you give your general the right? Who makes the call to surrender, basically? Is that the general, or do you have to go higher up in command? I don't know if it's the guy on the ground fighting, per se. In Source 2, I put two psukim that Rav Korman quotes from Parshas Mishpatim, where, after the fight, and Yaakov is going back to his camp, because he had been left alone at that point, in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, it says, Vayizrach lo Hashemesh. So there, we understand that the sun was healing him in some way, shape, or form. There are other explanations as well, but Rav Korman links this to the concept of a Baba Bachteris, somebody who's coming into your house, the Gana, the thief who's tunneling into your house, where in Pasuk Beis we say Imzarcha Hashem Ashalav Damim Lo Yishalim Yishalim, that literally if the sun is shining on them, then the way that Chazal understand is that if it's clear as day that he's not going to kill you, then you can't kill him. But the point being, you recognize who this person is and you recognize their intent. And that Rav Korman takes this as just kind of a way of speaking, at least in the times of Mikra. And so when it says that by Yaakov, it means he saw who it was that he was fighting. In the middle of the night, he couldn't recognize who the person was. But now that sun has risen, he sees that it's Achi and that it's all involved with Esau. Which is an interesting suggestion. I don't think it holds up for two reasons. One, it says in Shmos, there in Mishpatim, Im Zarcha Hashem Ash'alav, that it's on this person. And here in our parsha, it's Vayizrach Lo Hashemesh, for Yaakov. So that would change the phrase in my eyes a little bit. And also, he clearly, at the end of the fight, he clearly knows who it is, because he's saying, give me a bracha. If he didn't know until the sun rose later, how would he know to ask for the bracha, you know, if he's really asking for Esau to forego the rights and to kind of drop the grievance, as it were? It doesn't really add up. Yeah?
What's the rabbi?
Sorry?
The rabbi of Purim, Rabbi Korman?
Yeah, Avram Korman. He died in the 90s, I think. I don't have his bio with me right now. I put it on the source sheets from Toldos. But he grew up in Poland and made Aliyah, and he was close with kind of the Babov community in Poland, and then became more of a Mechaker, Torah, Mada type approach. And he has a whole slew of Svarim that they're all very interesting topics. And the stuff of his that I've seen, he often takes a very unique approach to understanding whatever it is he's discussing.
Using his
book, not the whole thing. Oh, I mean, I have his book, Ha'avos Vashvatim. So he talks about just kind of the beginning of the Torah up until Shmos and a little bit in the Midbar as well. And I, with Parshas Toldos, I just happened to look and see if he said anything, and I found this really interesting approach where the sale between Yaakov and Esau was the right to marry Leah, which is not really how we typically understand that sale. So I also just looked to the next chapter for this story to see what he said, and it is somewhat of a continuation. For the rest of the sheet, we're basically dropping his approach because it doesn't add up. I put up the shiur for Parshat Toldos. I put on Vayitor, and I put the chapter from his sefer on there. It's in Hebrew, but it's fairly straightforward. Lashon. Right. So there are a number of issues beyond what I've already said with Rav Korman's approach to that understanding of the fight between Yaakov and the Ish. I just put in bullet notes a couple more. If the Ish is actually a person, why would Yaakov ask for a blessing? I was listening to a shiur from Rabbi Mordechai Turchino where he put it like, if somebody mugs you on the street, your reaction after the mugging is not to ask them for a bracha. It's just not how it doesn't make any sense. Even more unusual, why would he give Yaakov the blessing? If this is just a random person that he's fighting, or even if it's Achi, according to Rav Korman, why would you give him the bracha? Why? How do you have that right? And again, if we're meant to assume that, what basis are we assuming that on? That's kind of coming out of left field. Also, if it's an actual person, that means it's an actual person giving Yaakov his new name of Yisrael. And when all the other Avos and Imahos receive new names, who gives them that new name? Hashem, exactly. It's not a person. It's not Achi, as it were. Or at the very least, it's a Malach, but coming, you know, as an emissary of Hashem. So basically, it's coming from Hashem. So based on those questions and what we'll see in just a moment, it seems clear that the Ish is not really an Ish. And if you look in Source 3, in Sefer Shoftim, when we have Manoach and his wife, the parents of Shimshon, receive news from Amalek that Shimshon will be born. It sounds in the story there that, like, Manoach doesn't really believe his wife, because the angel comes to his wife initially, and she goes and tells Manoach about it, and then Manoach turns to Hashem and asks, you know, I want to meet this angel. and so in Yud Zayin there, in the first pasuk, it says, V'yomer Manoach el Malach Hashem Mishmecha, where he asks the same question, what's your name? Same thing that Yaakov will ask the Malach. V'yomer lo Malach Hashem Lamazei Tishal Lishmi. Again, the same question. Why are you asking my name? Hu Feli. However, in this case, he answers them, which is interesting. And then they offer up a karban, and skipping down to the next bold one in Chaf Beis, Yomar Monoach al Ishto Mos Namus Ki Elokim Reinu. And again, that also parallels our story where that's why Yaakov names the place where this fight happened Peniel, Ki Reisi Elokim Panim El Panim. I've seen God face to face. I've seen godliness in some form face to face. And same thing that Manoach is saying here, where he's afraid that now we're going to die because we've just seen God. And his wife very logically says to him, well, if God wanted to kill us, then what's going on here? We'd already be dead. But just from that story, it seems very much like a parallel to our story of Yaakov that really builds some of the weight that this is actually a malach that he's fighting. On top of the fact that that's certainly the concept in the Masorah that we have from Chazal, and most, if not all, the Mefarshim seem to latch on to that, with the obvious exception of Rav Korman. I haven't seen anyone else say that it was an actual person. They kind of have the approach that it's a malach, and it was a real fight, or it was some sort of dream, nevuah fight. So now backing up to the beginning of the parsha, and we'll see a suggestion here from Rav Elchanan Samet, where he says there's a very interesting parallel that happens in the parsha. And this parallel is something that I'd seen when I was just going through the parsha, but I couldn't really figure it out completely. So I looked around and I saw he did figure it out. I thought it was some sort of chiastic structure where you go through a sequence of events and then you do it again in reverse. And this, he says, it's just a normal parallel where you do a sequence of events and then you repeat that same sequence in its normal order, in its original order. So we start off with, it sounds very tense moments, this initial kind of the first few psukim. Yaakov is told that there are 400 men coming, and we see in Rav Samet quotes from Shmuel that 400 men is a clear indication of war, because in Shmuel Aleph, David HaMelech and Shaul are in quite a serious fight, and David HaMelech is fleeing from Shaul, and he gathers 400 men with him, and part of that is preparation for battle. It's something that really builds the intensity of the build-up to the meeting with Esau, that this is, we're presumably preparing for war. And Rav Samet breaks these psukim into five basic sections, where he says there's the threat, that's the malachim, the scouts that Yaakov sends out. They tell him, well, there's a threat coming, it's Esau. So Yaakov decides he's going to divide up his camp, the Am, it says, Vayacha Etza'am, Esa'am, which is another, just to go back to Rav Korman, is another weakness, I think, of his approach, because he wanted to say that Yaakov was splitting up the camps to protect Leah and potentially Dinah, and so he was splitting up his family, and it's clear in the Pesukim that he never splits up his family. They're always together. When he takes them across the river, they're together. At the night when he wakes up in Pasuk Chaf Beis, they get up in the middle of the night and he takes them across the river. And later, when they actually meet Esav, everyone is there. All the wives and the children are there together with Yaakov, apparently on the front line. But Rav Samet breaks it in, again, threat, division, then the encounter, which is Yaakov and the Malach in the first section, the gift, which should be, I said that incorrectly. Let me just start that over. So the preparation, this is Yaakov preparing. He has the threat, which is the news of Esau coming to greet him. He decides, I'm going to divide up the camp or my wealth into different sections to presumably prevent damage. The encounter is him speaking, he's encountering God, he's speaking to God and describing some of what's going on. Then he's preparing the gift, the mincha, to give to Esav, and then movement, meaning to say now they're actually on the move, he's moving around his family and preparing for what's coming. And that ends with Pasuk Chaf Dalet 24, which then is the fight, which is kind of this random story stuck in between these two paralleled sections. So then he goes through in the actualization, which takes place during the daytime, which is also built up, changes some of the kind of the emotional texture of it. So the first part is very kind of basically terrifying, and there's a lot of tension, and that's at night. A great deal of it is at night, which also really builds that. And then when it actually occurs, everything that he's feared seemingly is going to take place. It's daytime, and you have the threat where he lifts his eyes and sees Esav. The division, where he says v'yachat es yaladim al leav al rachav al shtei shvachos. He doesn't divide them up and send them somewhere else. He just divides them up by mother. Who's the mother? Then the actual encounter with Esav, which is completely, it just almost loses all of that momentum that it built up in the first section, where all of a sudden Esav is just kind of lovey-dovey, at least according to one approach. And then the gift, he tries to give the gift to Esav, and he has to push him to take it, and then they go their separate ways. In the end, to me, it seems a lot like Yaakov is back to a position of power at the end, where he just goes on his way, and there's no indication that he really is going to have any sort of interaction with Esau from that point on. Even though he says, yeah, we'll meet in Seir, does he really go there? No, he goes to Sukkot. So again, Yaakov seems to be back in this place of power. So not only does it lose all the momentum, but it puts him back in a place of power, whereas before he was the one that didn't have power. He was under threat of attack. So what changes? What changed? So Rav Samet says it must be something going on with this story in the middle. And the understanding what goes on in that story in the middle will help us understand why everything seems to seemingly lose its momentum. So he says, first of all, he thinks it is, in fact, a malach. He accepts that normative approach, that it is a malach. And he says, although this explanation may appear to be drash, and thus it scared off pshat-oriented commentators such as Rashbam and Radak, it actually constitutes a depth of pshat approach, since it is only the only possible solution which can answer all the questions we have raised earlier. So he says, he quotes the concept which Rash and others bring, that this malach wasn't a random malach, it was the Tsar Shel Esav, the noble or kind of heavenly emissary of Esav, who there's this assumption or idea that every nation has their own Tsar, and that impacts things that go on in this world. Where if you look in the bullet note with Dot Mikra, they were explaining the same thing, and they say, we've explained in Dot Mikra to Daniel that any war that is waged between earthly governments or nations is only a reflection of a heavenly war being waged between the Tsar of each of those nations. And that this is when history and kind of a meta-history touch. History being the actual concrete events, and then meta-history being the principles that are guiding those. So the Tsar is kind of the meta-history, the principle guiding that. So what's happening is Yaakov is fighting kind of the spiritual momentum of Esav. And obviously this Tsar is the guiding force for Esav's war against Yaakov, and he seemingly would have the ability to give him a bracha and to say, we're letting go of this dispute over Birchas Avram, over the brachos that Yitzchak gave you, and Esav is no longer going to be pursuing your life. And when you take that, that's a really pivotal moment at that point, and that helps us understand why the momentum is taken out of the story afterwards, because now Esav doesn't have that Tsar pushing him forward to war with Yaakov. It's a completely different story now. Now it's more reconciliation on some level or another. In a later paragraph in his, this is the English translation that's on the Gush website. They also have the original Hebrew, and it's in the I can't remember the name of his sefer. We have it on the shelf over there, the Rav Samet sefer. Our story is one of the few instances in Tanakh where the veil lifts and we see how earthly reality, which generally fills the biblical stage, depends on another sublime and concealed reality, meaning all the idea of the Sar Shel Esav, etc. In fact, normal reality is merely a reflection of that more sublime reality. Why does this phenomenon occur specifically here in this story? Why was Esav Sar, heavenly emissary, sent to wrestle with Yaakov, thus determining the continuation of the story, the actual encounter with Yaakov and Esav? So then he goes and discusses that. But one theme I think a lot of Mefarshim attached to this is Maisa Avos Simin Labanim, that things that happen to the forefathers are a signal or kind of a sign for what will happen over the generations to their descendants. And that would answer Rav Samet's questions, that why is it happening here? There's something very significant for us as to why this is happening and why it's specifically with the fight between Yaakov and Esav. So I just have two more little pieces here that just take that into our own lives, where I looked around just to see what people say about this story in reference or in the context of Maisa Avos Simin Labanim. And I found two interesting statements which I think link very interestingly. One was Rav Chaim David Alevi in Shelas Tshuvas Aser L'Charav. He was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, if I'm not mistaken. And he studied in Yeshivat Parat Yosef with Father Yosef and others. So he's a fairly recent posek, a significant one at that. He has, in his Shalos and Tshuvas, has a discussion of the concept of Maisa Avos Simin Labanim, where he takes and he gives, here's what the Ramban says about it, and here's some midrashim that link into that. And then he takes it into more modern history, which obviously the Ramban links it to his times, but people hadn't done it for the 1930s or what have you. Or this is really post-1930s, because he discusses the Shoah. So he says, in discussing the concept of Maisa Avos Simin Labanim, he writes, we are permitted to assume that the fight with Esav's heavenly emissary, with his Sar, which was, in fact, intended to kill, he says, Lahashmid Yaakov, that fight hints to the staggering Holocaust. It's a reference in the Torah to the Holocaust, in his eyes. Because he's taking that concept of Maisa Avos Simin Labanim and applying it, saying, why do we have this story? It's a reference to the Holocaust, which is significant. Because as he continues in very much the same way that Source 6 continues. But I thought it was significant to see it from Source 6, because the Source 6 is the Eish Kodesh, the Piazentz and the Rebbe, from the Warsaw Ghetto. Obviously, writing from, in 1940, writing from the Holocaust, he was murdered in the Holocaust, and he says the same exact idea that Rav Halevi states immediately after the sentence I gave you. He says, "V'yomer lo ashlachah ki im birchatani." I'm not going to send you unless you give me a bracha. And v'na'avina lama hayatar Yaakov avinu shesaro shel Esav yivrchu halo kavar baruchu Hashem. Why does Yaakov want this Sar of Esav to bless him? He already has Hashem's blessing. What do you need a blessing from the Sar Shel Esav? That's not as significant as Birchas Hashem. Ma Shalom v'Amalach Ma Shimcha Ha'im Lo Yada Shmo. And further, why is the Malach asking Yaakov, what's your name? Presumably he knew who he's Sar Shel Esav. Of course he knows who Yaakov is. That's why he came to fight him. And so he says, Aval Maisa Avos Simin Labanim. What happened to the forefathers is a sign for us. So after he encounters this Tsar and fights with him, and also that the Malach injures him. Now the Tsar wants to leave. Amar Yaakov, Haim Kazos Yara Levni. So Yaakov says to himself that this could very well happen to my descendants. This is not a unique event. that after, and it, so it should be, that after they have been subjected and survived the persecution and attacks, that what happens afterwards, what I do afterwards, should in turn become their Yeshua. That their enemies shouldn't actually destroy them, that they shouldn't fall into the hands of their enemies. And furthermore, that they should return to the state, to the way of life that they had before they were attacked. Lochen rak lo ashalechecha, excuse me, that no, I'm not going to send you kim birchatani. She'achrei yehazurim v'yoshem Hashem v'yoshua. Lo rak shiyiftaru mitzarasehem bilvad. He says, no, I'm not going to send you unless you give me a bracha. It's not enough that you just leave and stop persecuting me. You also have to give me a bracha. You also have to enable me in some way, at least spiritually, to get back to where I was before you attacked me. Which, obviously, the PNSN and the Rebbe was not able to see, but obviously we see after the Holocaust the tremendous things that have happened, and it's an ongoing process, but one of the big examples that people quote is Hakamat Medina, where we have Eretz Yisrael now, we have it in our hands. That perhaps is a little bit of, is in some way fulfillment of what the Pesach Rebbe here is talking about, that Yaakov demands this bracha because he wants us to be able to get back to where we were after we unfortunately are inevitably attacked. Because that is part of the Maisa'ava Simon Labanim, that Yaakov was attacked, and so too we've been attacked. But just as he asked for that bracha and was able to reach tremendous heights, so too we should ourselves, as a community and individuals, be able to reach those heights as well. I hope everyone has a wonderful day and a good Shabbos.
Thank you very much.